Protests in recent weeks have revealed tensions between police and the Black Lives Matter movement. An incident in Springfield reported this morning underscores that tension. On May 30th, a detective in the Springfield Police Department posted a picture on Instagram of her niece holding a sign at a Black Lives Matter rally in Atlanta. It drew criticism from officers in her department. MassLive reports the detective was fired on June 19th by Springfield Police Commissioner Cheryl Claprood. The former detective joins us now from Springfield. Florissa Fuentes, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Florissa, your story was first reported by MassLive and Springfield Republican reporter Stephanie Berry. I wonder, can you walk us through what happened, beginning with what was the picture and why did you post it?
Yes, the posting was a photo of my niece and her friend protesting the killing of George Floyd. The protest took place in Atlanta, Georgia. My niece and her friend were holding signs. One of the signs read, "Who do you call when the murderer wears a badge?" And the sign that my niece was holding said, "Shoot the F back."
Okay. That content could be considered threatening. You acknowledge that the posting could be considered hurtful or threatening to fellow officers. Did you think about that when you posted it? I mean, it could be construed as threatening to you as a police detective as well.
I didn't take the post as being anti-cop. When I shared the post, I didn't think about how others would perceive it. At no point did I share that post with malicious intent. I was just solely, supporting my niece and her right to practice her First Amendment.
So then what happened, Florissa? You posted it. What did you hear from your department, from other officers? What happened next?
So after sharing the post, a few hours later, I received messages on social media, phone calls, text messages from some of my officers who expressed their concerns. They said that the post didn't look good, that it looked like an anti-cop post. Once I realized that I had offended some of my fellow officers, I immediately deleted the post, and I apologized to those who had reached out to me and also thanked them for, looking out for me. I know that at that time, emotions were very high for all the officers with everything that was going on and all the protests that was happening throughout the country. The following day, I received a phone call from my direct captain. Before he could explain himself, I explained that I know why he's calling me, but at no point did I share that post with malicious intent or any intent to harm or offend any of my fellow officers. But the captain stated that the commissioner was highly upset. She was embarrassed. And then I did express to him that I understand how she could be embarrassed and offended, especially after she honored hardship for me. The commissioner has done a lot for me throughout my career, my 1 year career in the department. Excuse me. The day after the phone call with the captain, I met with the commissioner, Commissioner Claprood. There was a few deputies in the office as well, a few captains, and I went in with my union president, Joe Gentile. In the meeting, the commissioner basically told me that, I embarrassed her and that she was highly upset with me, especially after honoring the hardship. I apologized to her, and I told her that I understand where my fellow officers are coming from, but at no time did I post that with malicious intent, and no time did I think that my post was being anti-cop. I told her that I should apologize to all the officers. I'm sorry, to all the supervisors who advocated for me. I think that they deserved an apology for me embarrassing them. And she went on to tell me that people had called up to the commissioner's office, and when I say people, I mean my fellow officers, and they were upset and they wanted me terminated. She did say that she thinks very highly of me and that she didn't want to terminate me and that I needed to figure out a way to fix this. After I left that meeting, I consulted with my union president, Joe Gentile. After consulting with him, we both agreed that it'd be a good idea to go on the local IBPO page and put up a public apology to my fellow officers. I put up the apology later that day, and once I put up the apology, I had a few officers that, basically told me it's okay, no worries, we all make mistakes, We have to stick together. But then I received a lot of insults and threats on there as well.
Fleurs, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I know there's a little more to this story, and I do want to give you a chance to tell it, but I need to clarify on a couple of things that you've already said. You said that the commissioner said to fix it. In the Mass Live reporting today, she denied that she had said fix it and had a quote that said, quote, "Once you post something, it's out there and you can't retract it. That post was hurtful to many of her coworkers." What do you make of the dispute between your sense that she told you to fix it and her saying that that is not what she said?
When I was in that meeting, I recall those words. It's like, you need to figure out a way to fix this. I remember, go ahead.
No, that's okay. Finish your thought, please.
I'm done commenting on that.
Okay. Also, you said that the commissioner honored hardship for you. Some of our listeners may not know what that means. Can I please ask you to explain that?
Yes. So during the pandemic, the kids were being homeschooled. And I also have my father who has cancer that I care for. So I put in I spoke with my captain. I was on the midnight shift. I was working 12 to 8 a.m. And I wrote up a hardship after consulting with the captain. He told me to put in a hardship. I wrote to the commissioner asking to go back to 4 to 12 as a patrol officer and in order for me to homeschool my three children and look after my father. A few days later, she honored my hardship as well and threw me in the PB as a SVU detective.
So made you a detective?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Now, after you posted the apology, you got mixed results or responses from that apology. My understanding was ultimately you withdrew the apology. You then later were part of a larger picture that was taken of the force, and then on that same day received news that you could either resign or be fired. Do I have those events correct?
Yes.
And so the firing was about a week and a half ago.
Yes, it was on Friday, June 19th.
And did it come as a surprise to you on that day?
Yes, it did. After I spoke with some of the supervisors in the department, they had basically told me, you know, lay low, just try to blend in, you know, take this as a small bump in your career and a lesson learned, and you'll get through this.
Why do you think you were fired?
At this point, you know, I honestly don't know. I feel like the commissioner stated, she was pressured by the mayor. I think it was driven by politics. But that's as far as I can comment on that.
Were there discussions within the police force during the weeks of the protests prior to you posting your social media post about the protests, the movements, the discussions about police brutality? Were you talking with fellow detectives or other officers about that? And did you have a sense of where they stood, and did they have a sense of where you stood?
No, we didn't talk much about it. I mean, I had one officer who I spoke with that I was very close with in regards to the protest, and I think we both stood in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. But other than that, I didn't really have conversations about the protest with other fellow officers.
And after you posted your apology, why do you believe that some officers came back with strong responses, threatening language, I think is the term that you used, et cetera? Why do you believe the apology was not sufficient to kind of to begin to heal the controversy around your post?
I believe emotions are just very high at this time. You know, I can't tell you why they felt offended. Again, I had some allies, and then I had some officers that attacked me.
Fleurs, we reached out to the Springfield Police to either appear on the show or to provide comment. Commissioner Cheryl Klaprud sent us a statement. It said, quote, "This was Ms. Fuentes' second infraction during her probationary period. Complaints about her social media posts came from coworkers who were hurt by it and questioned her stance on the quote that advocated shooting police officers. It was my decision to terminate her employment," end quote. What does she mean by a second infraction?
During the time of my during the academy, I got into a verbal dispute with a family member. That family member had filed a police report. I was in the academy, and one of the lieutenants who was the director of the academy, spoke to me about it. He said that, you know, they'd have to write up the incident. He asked me to write on it, and that was pretty much the end of that. I didn't think that that would actually come back and haunt me now, or that the department would use that as an excuse to fire me.
This was one of your family members, you mean? One of your family members?
Yes, it was the girlfriend of my brother's girlfriend.
Okay. And how long did you have left in your probationary period? I understand that probationary period is a standard period of time for a new officer. Is that correct?
Yes. I had about a month.
How long did you have left?
About a month left.
Okay.
My probation would have ended on July 18th.
Now, you did not anticipate being fired, as we've established. How were you thinking about how you would go forward to heal this rift with fellow officers had you not been fired? Do you think it would have been possible?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
So had you not been fired, how were you thinking about what else you were going to do or needed to be done to help heal this rift with fellow officers that you were experiencing?
I mean, it hurts to know that I genuinely apologized and I was attacked by these officers. But I was dedicated to my job. I'm a Latina woman who grew up in this community. My heart is with the city, and I went to work every day and I did my job. Whether people liked me or they didn't like me, I was dedicated. And for those 8 hours I was at work, my focus was the community. Whether someone liked me or not, if they needed help, I was going to be there for them. And I was hoping with time, things can heal within the department.
Florissa, this story broke today. Have you heard anything from the department today or from the city of Springfield?
No, I have not.
And what will you do now? Would you even want to go back to the Springfield police? Do you have something else in mind that you'd like to do next? What's your next step?
So when I left, my final conversation with Commissioner Clabrood, we both acknowledged that there was no hard feelings. She stated that she was pressured by the mayor to terminate me. And if I could get my job back, I would take it without second guessing. Again, I'm a member of the community. I do a lot within the community. I coach basketball. I train domestic violence victims. I do a lot within the community. And this is where my heart is. And if I could get my job back, I would take it.
That's Florissa Fuentes. She's a former police detective who served in Springfield. Florissa, I appreciate you joining us today. Thanks for telling us your story.
Thank you.
In our nation's increasing racial awareness, we are looking at July 4th differently this year. Yes, it is about celebrating our nation's independence, reflecting on the foundation of America, but it's also about recognizing who wasn't liberated with our country's independence and reflecting on the work that still needs to be done. To that point, Boston and the country have seen tremendous public and social action on race and police brutality over the past more than a month. And behind a lot of that energy and movement in Boston are young women of color. And so we wanted to reflect on the past month of activism and new leadership in that activism. And we invite you to join us in that reflection. Is something different about this moment? Are new activists coming forward, and do they inspire you or move you? What has been your experience? And have you participated in this push for change? Or are you uncomfortable with how far it's gone? We welcome all your thoughts. You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So joining us first to have this conversation is Hoden Hashi. She's with the new organization Black Boston, which represents the voices of young people of color. She co-organized a march protesting the death of George Floyd that drew thousands. Hoden, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Hoden, we're also joined by Vickiana Petit-Home. She's a regional organizer with March for Our Lives and worked with local organizers on an effort to defund the Boston police budget by at least 10%. Welcome to you too, Vickiana.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So let me start by asking both of you to reflect on this past month of activism where you have been young leaders. Do things feel different to you? And Hoden, maybe you can go first.
Yeah, I can definitely touch on that a little bit. Things, they do feel different in a sense, but they also, and I think that a lot of young Black people and young Black women especially can speak to this, they feel very much the same. I feel like the conversations that I personally have been having and the things that I've been doing have been things that I've been talking about and doing for years now. But in a sense, it does feel different because it does feel different because it feels like people are starting to pay more attention and more people are starting to join in on the movement. So the work has been happening. The work has been happening for decades and for centuries. But in a sense, this moment is something like we do have a spotlight of attention that I think is a little bit different from what was happening before.
Vickiana, do you agree? How are you reflecting on this last month or so?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that sentiment. I think also, though, I think the sense of unity that Boston is feeling is somewhat different. You know, at the march that Black Boston hosted, and great job, Chihuda, you know, like 26K showed up, you know, during a pandemic. So I feel like Boston has never really been so united. But not only that, I think people aren't so easily tamed by simple rhetoric anymore. They're demanding actual substantial changes, and these politicians are getting flustered, I think. And I think we're really starting to see a new wave of activism, and this is just the beginning for sure.
Hoden, Vickiana just talked about the scale of the march in Boston, the large one that happened on May 31st. It started with an idea you and three other young women had on Twitter. You're very active on Twitter. The march was peaceful. I'm sure our listeners and you remember there was chaos and looting later on in the evening. Did you have a sense of how big that march was going to get? And can you reflect on that day for us?
Yeah, definitely. We definitely... I don't think that I could have ever in my wildest dreams imagined that many people to come together at a protest that three college-age students organized off of Twitter. The two other organizers, we didn't even know each other before we started this. So it was really one of the most impactful things about that protest was it was really a protest of the people. Like it was organized by the people. It was supported by the people. So speaking to what Vickiana was saying, like this is very much like Boston coming together as a city and kind of deciding that enough is enough. I never thought that something like that could have happened, but it only speaks to how we're feeling in the city. Like we are tired and we are ready for change, and that change starts with the police, but it comes from a lot of different places, and we're ready to start having that conversation.
Listeners, join this conversation. Are you tired? Is there a change in the air? Are you ready to do something different than you've done before to achieve that change? And are you ready for young leaders to take you in that direction? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Vickiana, what is it about this moment that tens of thousands of people will turn out, especially during a pandemic when we know we need to be masked, we need to be socially distanced, when large crowds can threaten one's health and well-being? Why in this moment have people come to the streets in this way?
Well, I can speak to a little bit to like what I and what motivates me and my peers, but it's kind of horrifying, though, that I think, like, this pandemic it's opening people's eyes to a lot of the injustices. Some people are just figuring things out, but this isn't just, you know, another event and we snapped. You know, this has been piling up and up and up. And we see the consequences of COVID. Black and brown people are more affected. They're more likely to die from COVID because of underlying health issues. That's a product of our policies and our systems, you know, and the lack of resources we put into communities of color. It's all building up. And so to see that not only are we being killed by these injustices, we're being killed by COVID, but then also, you know, during the midst of all this, another Black person was shot by police. And it just feels like a lot. But it feels like if we don't fight, we're going to die anyway, so we might as well put up the fight. That's how I feel about it. And that's how I felt my peers have felt about it. You know, it kind of just feels like Black and brown people are being surrounded by all sides, you know, being attacked at all sides. And so we can only put up a fight.
Houghton, let me give you a chance to react to that before I go on to another question.
No, I definitely wholeheartedly agree with that. I think that it can be very easy to simplify the message of the movement. It can be very easy to say that it's only about police, or it's only about one man being shot, or it's only about certain things. But I think something that people do need to understand is this movement is about, it's about systems. It's about police, but it's also about the systems that are put in place to protect the police, to protect their image. Mm-hmm. Even going as far as media, we organized a protest with 25,000 people, and we were peaceful. We had masks, we had water, we all supported each other. People had donations coming in, and we were united. And then I got home that night, and all I saw on TV was about the looting, about the violence, and the message is also being changed. So the media plays a role in this. The government plays a role in this. So it's a lot more than just the police. And I don't want that message to be watered down as well. And I think that there's a lot of different entities that need to be held accountable in a time like this.
Houghton, I do want to ask you, is there anything you feel that you could or should have done differently in the way you organized that day that might have led to a different outcome later that night?
I feel like in any situation like this, you can always look back and you'll have things that you would have wanted to do differently. At the end of the day, like, the organizers who did organize this, this is our first time doing anything like this. And again, like, the scale to which it happened was not something that anyone could have predicted. But what I will say is I don't think that there's anything that we as organizers could have done to change the response that we received. I think that no matter what had happened, no matter how we tried to play respectability politics or anything like that, what happened would have happened.
Let's go to the phones. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Chris on the line from Nashua, New Hampshire. Chris, go ahead.
Hi. I was just listening to your guests, and I was thinking about a conversation I had yesterday with a friend in Mexico who asked me, what's different between these protests and the ones that happened when I was younger in California, with Rodney King, for instance. And mm-hmm. I remarked to her about how proud I am of these young people for their commitment to nonviolence and to real substantive conversation. It gives me great hope in the midst of all this COVID and all this tension that we really can carve a way forward, because that's how to do it. So I do work in nonviolence, and I just admire the generation that is taking this lead.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for that call. Vickiana, let me give you a chance to react to that.
Yeah, you know, I think young people have always led movements. And I also want to say, like, the same issues that were around back then when you were a child, unfortunately, are still around here today. I think, like, us young people were taking the helm and we're trying these strategies, but we're also learning from those protests. We're learning about what they did, and we're replicating some of that. But we're also learning from their mistakes. So I think, you know, young people has always led, and they'll continue to lead, and you know, that generational solidarity is like so important to making sure that this work actually is fruitful and that we all achieve our goals, because it's not just going to take us young people, you know. We all need to put our part in this and play our part in this.
Hoden, you and Vikiana are young leaders. Can you tell me what in your life and in your experience growing up in Boston got you to this place and both prepared you and motivated you to do this kind of leadership work?
I think in a lot of ways I kind of fell into work like this. I don't think that it was ever intentional in the sense of, like I said before, a lot of the things that I do choose to talk about and speak out about are things that I experience on a day-to-day basis. A lot of the times, the daily experience of Black women is politicized. My life and my actions are inherently political to a lot of people, so that puts me in positions where anything that I say or do or experience kind of does get put in this light. So growing up, I did experience quite a bit of racism in the city of Boston. I went to a private school when I was in high school. And so I had to, from a very young age, be able to understand kind of the politics and the history behind why I was being treated the way that I was being treated. And that's something that a lot of people have the privilege to not have to think about at such a young age. But because that was my experience, I very early was able to talk about these things in a way where people started listening, and that's just how I kind of fell into where I am now. It's also just something I'm very passionate about. So it's kind of those two things coming together that have brought me where I am.
Vikiana, I understand you had a different kind of high school experience, but that also shaped you. Can you reflect on how it might have been different than Hoden's and how it brought you to this leadership you're doing now?
Yeah, so I went to Boston Latin Academy as a high schooler, and that's a majority minority school. Like, although racist things still happen there, you know, we have a lot of white administration and all of that. But you know, it was a really great example of what happens when you give Black and Brown students, you know, resources and money and, you know, the possibilities that can come out of it, you know. And that really inspired me. And I got involved in the Mayor's Youth Council around sophomore year. That experience, learning from so many other young people from around the city, constantly meeting and talking about how we see Boston and where we want it to go and where we want it to be, and the values we wanted to enshrine it. And it let me know that, like, even though I was young, like, I was powerful as hell, and that, you know, I kind of already knew, like, my community and what needed to be done, and I didn't have to wait until I was older to start making the changes that I wanted to make. Through that, I got involved through several different organizations, such as March for Our Lives, working on gun violence prevention, but the one thing that always, like, stuck down was just, like, this racial equity lens, how all these issues, you know, they affect all of us. But at the end of the day, like, race plays such a huge factor into our lives. So thinking about and centering Black and Brown folks in my advocacy and in my organizing, that just always became core to what I did.
So let me ask you both, what do you want from the city of Boston for change now? Hoden, what are you trying to change now?
There's a lot. I think that change, before we even get to change, I feel like change, one, starts with acknowledgement. True acknowledgement in the sense of, like, I feel like it's been a month since the protest that we organized, and to this day, we have not necessarily been acknowledged. I don't feel like we've gotten a genuine acknowledgement from the mayor and from a lot of other city officials, in the sense of not just saying, hey, we hear you, but showing it and committing yourself to actually listening to what we have to say. And then from there, a lot of organizers in the city that have been doing work far longer than we have do have very specific demands, whether that's with the police, whether that's with like the budget, and we're here to support them and the demands that they have.
And Vickiana, the budget has been passed by the city now. Mm-hmm. You were pushing for a 10% reduction. What is next for you?
Yeah, the mayor declared racism to be a public health emergency, and then he continued not to do what it took mm-hmm. to actually address the issue. He proposed a $12 million cut, which was equivalent to 2% of the overall budget, of the PPD budget, and all the counselors, they always mentioned how they've gotten so many letters and emails and calls about this issue, way more than ever before, and yet, eight voted to keep the budget as is, and only five really listened to us and listened to our demands,
So, it's so you have more work to do there.
Yeah, we need them to actually do the work that they're trying to say that they're doing and listen to us. But it's also about these structures, the fact that we're now getting people involved in the budgeting process, that's not okay. It shouldn't take a moment like this for people to pay attention. This budget is our money. It funds our schools. It funds our communities. We should have more direct access to that. We should have more direct communication with our counselors about that. We should be at the center of it. It should be more transparent. It shouldn't be this one-off case that people are looking at them, It's our money.
And that's Vickiana Petitholm. She's a regional organizer with March for Our Lives. Vickiana, thanks for the time today.
Thank you.
And Hoden Hashi, she's with Black Boston, which represents the voices of young people of color in the city. Hoden, thanks to you too.
Thank you for having me.
With the July 4th holiday weekend coming up, you might be getting ready for a socially distanced visit with family or friends. And in our current moment, with partisan divides felt deeply in the Black Lives Matter movement sparking important but uncomfortable conversations about race, you might be dreading some of those interactions, even if they're virtual. So, how do we talk to each other and find common ground at a time when we are so deeply divided? That was the question that Divided We Fall, Unity Without Tragedy sought to answer. I participated as a host in this reality-style television experiment. The premise? You gather 12 people from opposite sides of our political divide, put them together for a weekend, film everything, and allow them to talk to each other not as advocates or members of any specific political party, but as individuals. We did it twice, once with Gen Xers in Massachusetts and once with millennials in Chicago. How'd it go? Well, a documentary special about it will air on Channel 2 tomorrow night. And joining us now to talk about it are two cast members. We have Khadija Amin from the Chicago cast and Joe Thibodeau from the Ashfield, Massachusetts cast. Khadija and Joe, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana.
Hi, good afternoon.
It's so great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you.
Good afternoon, same here.
Thanks, Joe. And I'm going to invite listeners to join this conversation as well. Talk with Joe and Khadija. Are you struggling to talk across differences, especially political differences? Do you have questions? Have you had a positive experience that you want to share or an approach that's worked for you? Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So Khadija, Joe, before we get to how the weekend went, I want to ask you to go back. Do you remember what you were thinking when you agreed to participate? Khadija.
I think I remember thinking, I'm always getting in trouble for talking about politics, so why not do it for a good cause with a group of people who want to bridge the divide? So it felt like a good use of like my natural personality to kind of talk about these things.
And how about you, Joe?
For me, I a little apprehension, not sure what I was getting into, but with a lot of things that I do, I was certainly willing and open to, seeing how it worked, but a little apprehension at first, but it certainly subsided quickly.
And let me ask you both, what was the experience like?
It was great. It was difficult at times because you're in a room with a bunch of strangers and you're being asked to be vulnerable and transparent and very honest. And I mean, some people are naturally all those things, but sometimes to get into that space with people that you don't know and don't have that level of comfort with is not always easy. But I felt like it was a successful weekend as far as I left it feeling like I could have conversations with people who had extremely different beliefs for me, and it didn't have to be an attack, a tear down. It didn't have to be negative. It could just be a conversation where we both walked away knowing something new.
Joe, you were in a different cast. Was that your takeaway as well? Did you have the same experience?
Yes. So originally, again, walking in and seeing 11 other people that you've never met before, and you don't know what's going to happen. But ultimately, with the conversation, by the end of the weekend, it didn't matter where we stood on any type of politics. We left in the Massachusetts cast. We left very friendly, and I believe we're all real good friends at this point.
It wasn't always easy. I remember that, Khadijah, you talked about that. Was there a particularly tough moment for you during your weekend experience, Khadijah?
That's kind of hard. I think there were a few moments that were difficult, and they were difficult for various reasons. Like having the gun conversation and talking about gun control and trying to dissect what gun control means to everyone, and some people having a very personal vested interest in it, and sometimes that made that conversation difficult. Or when we were talking about, you know, what's it going to take, what steps should we propose to leadership in charge of our country to as like a first step going forward to a more unified nation. And in our breakout group, what came up was, you know, an apology for the act of slavery, and then that became a conversation that was a little more difficult to have, and it made people uncomfortable because a lot of people don't want to talk about these type of things and talk about bad things in our history as a country.
But Khadijah, I'm just going to stop you there to put it into context. And that was like 15 months ago. It's not like this conversation you're talking about happened in the moment that we're in now. It was a while ago.
Oh yeah, no. Yeah, it was a while ago. This was in January 2019. So completely different climate, and to have that awkward conversation. So you can imagine trying to have it now. Honestly, I think people are a little more receptive now, which is a good thing.
Joe, I'm going to turn to you, but I want to invite callers into this conversation as well. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. How are you thinking about difficult conversations about politics, about race, across the divide right now? Do you have questions or thoughts? Call in and join this conversation. So, Joe, I want to play some sound for you here. With both casts, we started to really recognize where people came from, and the cast members started to recognize that they came from different places. When we asked you about proudest and least proud moments as Americans, I want to listen to a little bit of that from the documentary.
Proudest moment was when Donald Trump got elected. I'm very proud of Americans.
The next question is, what is your least proud moment as an American?
It was the election of Trump. I see it as a symptom of something being very wrong in our country.
So the same moment was someone's proudest moment and someone else's least proud. And we heard the same two perspectives on the election of President Obama. What do you and did you make of that? I mean, where does that put us?
Well, again, like I said during the weekend, I think it's people's personal biases or personal experiences that they're bringing to any conversation. And as I said on the show, I think sometimes when you are in a particular camp or a group, sometimes you're going to protect that group at all costs. And as a result, if someone is attacking your group, I think all humans have a natural instinct to kind of want to fight back. And I think sometimes we're closed-minded. So someone else's best moment, they're looking at it one perspective, and then someone else in a different camp might look at it as totally different and feel as though they're being attacked. and then have a totally different perspective on it. So I think it's more how individuals are looking at particular situations.
So what did you two learn, and I'll invite you both to answer this, what did you two learn from that weekend about how you get people to back away from that sort of defensive crouch of, God, my most proud moment is your least proud moment. How are we ever going to talk to each other, especially without judgment?
I can say that from my
perspective. Joe, go ahead. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, jump in, Joe. That's fine.
Yeah, no, go
okay.
for it, Joe.
No, I was just going to say, okay, thank you. No, I was just going to say, one of the things that we did on the show, very upfront, was setting ground rules. And I think we may have minimized, or sometimes people might minimize, the importance of that, because we ultimately all agreed that it was okay to disagree, but, you know, try to listen to each other, be respectful. Don't be thinking about your next sentence that you want to throw in without listening to the other person's perspective. I always like to say that, you know, we were given two ears and one mouth for a reason. We should be listening more than talking. And I think sometimes people don't do that. They just want to get their point out without listening. And I thought setting the ground rules and recognizing that we each gave everybody the ability that if someone started to break the ground rules, although I don't think it really ever happened, that we empowered everybody to be able to remind us of it. So from that perspective, I think if you're going to have those conversations with family or friends, you know, emotions really get involved sometimes. And I think we have to remember we got to respond to stuff and not just react through emotions. So to me, setting ground rules and knowing that you can stick to them was an important part of the weekend and having these important conversations with people.
Khadijah, how about you?
Yeah, I totally agree with Joe. That was well said, Joe. It was very important to have those ground rules. And there's such a value in that because things can become so emotional, as we see so much political conversations get so rooted in people's emotions. And so aside from the ground rules, which are super important, I would also say listening with empathy and going into the conversation very open. Back to Joe's point, not looking to react or waiting to respond to what you're hearing, truly hearing and trying to understand and trying to connect with what you're hearing and putting yourself in that other person's shoes to try to understand where they're coming from. Because for the most part, at least what we learned in our groups, is that we're not making these choices to be malicious or tear down any other groups. It's for the betterment of what we want. And so once you understand that from another person's perspective, you can understand why they're moving the way they are moving. And it helps to kind of find common ground and to speak to what's important to them. Now, when people just fundamentally agree, you know, there's nothing you can really do about that. Disagree, excuse me.
Well, that doesn't seem to be the problem. I was going to say, fundamentally agree doesn't seem to be the problem we're struggling with. I want to bring forward an interesting exchange that happened in the Chicago cast during a full group meeting. Kimberly, who is white, and Ernest, who is black, had an exchange. Kimberly said she didn't like that she felt people who had never voted before showed up to vote for President Obama because of his skin color. And then Ernest asked her why she felt that way when there have been other black candidates in the past who didn't garner the same support. Now, later on at the all red breakfast table, eventually in the weekends, the tables are divided out red and blue. Here's how Kimberly talked about it with cast members Tommy and Patricia, both of whom are black.
I don't like to be called racist because I am not. And that's why I said I am not right away.
Well,
I
don't say that. I'm telling you, stop saying
that. Never say that again.
Never say that again.
You don't have to say that.
Yeah. Because I am not.
That's like the worst thing you can say. Yeah. I'm not racist.
Nope.
So, Khadijah, you were there. You were part of the Chicago cast. What did you make of those exchanges?
Sorry, it's just so funny hearing Tommy and Patricia like, stop saying that. the exchange, I will say this because it was so poignant to me that Kimberly said, you know, I say that I'm not a racist because I don't like to be called that. And, you know, I don't think anyone who actually exhibits racist behavior and ideology, you know, likes to be called a racist. I think no one really likes to be labeled these things that are being deemed as bad by the greater society. And so I say it's all reflected in your actions and your intent, right? words are one thing, but actions and intent are another. So if you are carrying yourself in a manner that is projecting racism, such as systematic racism, right? Like, we're understanding now in the moment that we live in that racism isn't just the overt, you know, I don't like you because you're of another ethnicity. You know, there's systematic racism. And if you are blind to it, then you're kind of feeding it, right? Because you're not calling out that this is wrong. And so it's all about actions. If your actions are fueling something that is racist, you may not be a racist, but you are participating inadvertently. And so it's, I would say that if someone is calling you out in a way that you don't like when Kimberly was being called out, yes, you're going to get defensive and you're going to feel bad. And that's not great, but it's also a moment where you can, instead of being super defensive, you can take a look at yourself and kind of do some self inventory. Why are these people thinking this of me? Why would someone think that? You know, what am I exhibiting? And once you do that inventory, if you find as though, you know, you're not in the wrong, you are in the wrong, whatever the case may be, it's a moment to take stock, because quite frankly, I don't think everyone's going to sit around a group of 10 people and all point fingers at one person and say that one person is bad and that person be like, no, you're all wrong, right? If everyone is saying it, then maybe there's a moment for you to stop and think, what am I doing?
So I want to stop you there just only because we only have about a minute left, and I want to ask the two of you a question together. Khadija, you're a Black woman. Joe, you're a white man and a police officer. I have you here together saying it is possible to find common ground across divides. What is your advice to listeners about the first step in doing so in their own lives? Joe, why don't you go first?
Well, I think we all have to recognize that Black lives all do matter. And we need to, you know, get along all together. As the police officer of both castes, that was one of the things that I always wanted to try to bring to it, is we have to work together, you know, the police and the public. And so for me, it's more of, we can't do it alone. We're the same people that are shopping with you at stores and behind lines and going to the same school. So we just want everybody's support, and we want to all work together. And for me, that was really important.
And Khadija, just briefly, a thought from you. We've got about 20 seconds.
Yeah, like I mentioned before, just going into it with openness and empathy, looking to understand the other person and not, you know, not be right.
Khadija Amin and Joe Thibodeau, two cast members from the PBS documentary Divided We Fall, Unity Without Tragedy. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Thank you.
It's airing tomorrow night on Channel 2 at 10 p.m. You can find more information about it on our website, radioboston.org.